alternate solutions. If you need help with other volunteers for chaperones, that's something that can be solved. It hasn't been asked.
We have two gyms. I know we have a huge courtyard. I don't know why they couldn't have a plan B.
And the audacity of some of the staff members there in how they responded to some concerns by students. So, for example, they said, and this was this past weekend, tickets for Saturday's dance went on sale on Wednesday and were being sold before school and during their 20-minute lunch break through Thursday. However, students and parents say around 10:30 a.m. on Thursday, students received an email saying tickets were sold out. So some kids went up and said, hey, is there anything that you could do? Is there nothing that you can do to just help us? And the response was, sorry, you shouldn't wait until the last minute to get a ticket. That is absurd. Shame on the staff member who wrote that, because there are students like Liam who had plans to go to this dance. They made dinner reservations around it. And so now they had to basically figure out alternative plans that, if I'm being totally honest, don't seem all that interesting.
We still have our dinner reservations. We still have our outfits. And we're planning to go have fun bowling at a friend's house, party, wherever. Find something else to do.
That sounds awful, bowling. And by the way, this is how gang involvement starts. You get kids out of their comfort zone and some of the activities that they had planned, and you put them out on the streets. And then before you know it, some guy named T-Bone stares at them and says, hey, I've got a proposition for you. Let's go ahead and ransack a Wawa. Oh, yes, we don't have Wawa in convenience stores. Let's just go to the 7-Eleven. No, seriously, though, I'm kind of disgusted that this is how the Kent School District, or at least Kent Ridge High School, handled this. I think it is so despicable of them. Sorry, as one of the parents said in that clip, you've got two gyms. You've got parents who are willing to step up. This is, for a lot of them, the seniors, this is their last year of high school. Some of them aren't going to go to college. And you had already ruined a half of their high school career because of the shutdowns. And you couldn't come up with any accommodations whatsoever beyond just shaming people for not buying tickets early? How dare you? And you know what? If I was a parent in this district, and I wouldn't be because I don't like kids, so I won't be a parent. But if I were, I would be giving them a piece of my mind, and I would make sure that they do not live this down. Because let's be honest, they do this once, it means they're going to do it again. Now this.
The interview.
So apparently I-90 was an absolute mess this weekend. It turns out people are still waiting, stuck in traffic on I-90. It's been like 72 hours. Helping us explain what's going on before we send him out to help rescue some people from I-90 is Chris Sullivan from our sister station, Cairo News Radio. What in the world happened?
Apparently, a lot of people did not go to mynorthwest.com/chokepoints last Tuesday when I did a very long article about, hey guys, I-90 is going to be closed this weekend in the westbound direction. Or they weren't listening to me in the morning. They were obviously listening to Brian during the morning show instead of me over at 97.3 when I said 18 times, hey, I-90 is going to be closed today. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they closed all lanes of westbound I-90, all lanes, with the exception of the off-ramp and on-ramp at West Mercer Way, which is the last exit on Mercer Island before you get to the lake. And the reason they did that is that the night before, they had shut down the ramp to do the expansion joint there. Then they opened that ramp so that Mercer Island residents would have the ability to get off the island to the west. What they did not expect everybody to do, which is what everybody did, and what we had tried to tell people all week not to do, was go onto I-90, onto Mercer Island, realize that the bridge is closed, and then try to commando through all the neighborhoods of Mercer Island to get to that West Mercer Way on-ramp to get across the lake. And so what that did is it backed up I-90 for miles.
For hours.
Which backed up
there were people,
405.
People were stuck. I saw 5 hours.
Two, three, four, five, yeah.
So I literally saw someone who took out like a lawn chair and sat on top of his car. He said he was there for 5 hours.
Yeah, because there was nothing you could do, because getting off at that ramp and then getting back on, that, I mean, it's the size of this, just a little tiny ramp. It could not handle the capacity of I-90. So that backed up there, backed up Mercer Island, backed up 405, backed up Bellevue Way, backed up parts of Bellevue. And so the question was, why didn't anybody let us know about this? I'm like, well, we did.
Well,
we tried, but
no, I'm going to push back a little bit. You did, yes.
Yeah, well,
the state did not do a very good job on this. Because, and here's the deal. I vaguely remembered I-90 was going to be closed, and I had to get to Renton from Seattle on Saturday. Now, I drove out there thinking, oh, no, it's going to be bad. So I completely avoided I-5. I just took 99 all the way down.
Okay.
And then cut over.
Makes
and I
sense.
Was fine. On the way back, there was no traffic on I-5 at all. And I don't remember seeing any signage anywhere that suggested I-90 was closed.
And well, again, it was only closed in the westbound direction.
But you would still expect a bunch of signs, wouldn't you?
Yeah, and one thing I will get on WashDOT about is the signage, because we drove through there, southbound 405, to head out of town about 45 minutes after the closure on Friday morning. And the signs were not necessarily clear that while it said 90 is closed on Mercer Island, it didn't give you the impression that you couldn't go any further mm-hmm. than Mercer Island. So when I drove down through this Friday morning, I looked at the signs. I'm like, I'm not sure if that's going to tell people enough information. That sounds like a Mercer Island problem, not an I-90 all the way problem. So I get a frantic phone call from the Department of Transportation Saturday morning. I'm at my son's football game at Eastern Washington. And they're like, Chris, we've got to get out. We're changing the way we're doing things. Last night was terrible. And then the signage changed to no Seattle access mm-hmm. on westbound I-90. Had they put that out Friday, I think that would have been a lot more helpful for the people who were stuck in this.
They just called you and asked for free labor?
Well, they called me
what
up
are you,
and
their
said,
publicist?
Well, no, it was like, because I wasn't aware it was happening because I wasn't tuned into the news I was doing. And so they wanted to know who to reach out to at the desk to get the information out.
Radical idea. And this is and I say that somewhat facetiously, but they've got a large budget, including for media buys. When you've got this kind of incident, why not just blanket the airwaves, pay for it? Because you can't just expect for, you know, the Cairo 7 at 11 o'clock to give you one plug or you to give them a couple plugs. Pay for some advertisements and get it out there. I mean, this is a major shutdown. This is not something that was tiny.
No, and it was something that was planned and was something that, you know,
they
had talked about.
Why don't they do that?
That's an interesting point. I can bring that up as, you know, maybe they don't.
Buy some ads. Just blanket them. It's not that. Yes, Seattle is an expensive market. But if you go on all the radio stations for a week and the TV stations for the week, or even just 2 or 3 days leading into it, I guarantee you that that's going to make a difference.
I think you're probably right. That's a good
web
that's,
ads.
That's something that I can, maybe there's an issue for, you know, what they do in terms of spending public dollars on advertising. But when it has a public import like this and creates such a problem, that might not be a bad idea. I mean, this weekend, 520 is going to be closed for construction.
But no one takes 520.
What also got really upset, well, a lot of people did over the weekend, and because I-90 was closed, and they were all super PO'd that they had to pay the toll.
Which happened. What do we do every single year, especially when they close it down for the Blue Angels? And I always say, are they going to give you a little bit of a pass on 520? No, we're not.
Nope. And they can't, according to state law.
Oh, yeah, they can.
Financing.
They always follow the law to the letter.
Well, I'm just saying the financing, the way it's set up to pay back the bonds is tied to the toll. And so that's one of the reasons why they never, and they say they can't, but
just
I'm just
quick,
giving you the reason.
Did they finish all the work they needed to do?
As far as we know, yeah.
Okay,
yeah,
so this is not going to happen again, at least on I-90?
No, it shouldn't. I mean, this is the pretty good, it was one of the original expansion joints, actually, from the floating bridge, so it needed
to be
replaced.
Yeah, there's no question as to whether or not it needed to happen. It's just
this one
they did a really poor job letting people know. You've got Seahawks,
the Huskies
game.
Yeah,
I mean,
packed.
Come on, man, this is ludicrous. And it felt like this was for the first time, because usually I do have a general understanding of what's going on, and I'm not even a driver. But this weekend I had to drive. I was like, oh, I'm pretty sure this is supposed to happen. And it didn't even impact. It wouldn't have impacted me, but I still went a different route.
Yep.
Just get the word out. And they're so bad. They cannot just say, hey, Chris, send out a few tweets for me, unless you charge them.
No.
You should. No, I'm saying you should.
Well, yeah, I should, but no. It was one
just
of those things where they did put out tweets all week long. But again,
no
you're
one
right.
follows WashDOT on Twitter, okay? They follow
I
me.
I do.
I've got 100,000 followers. They're following me.
Wow,
so you pay
great.
Me, and I'll put out the message.
That's way more than me.
Well, yeah, you're sad.
I know. No one. Again, if people followed me, they might have known.
What's
this
your
was
Twitter?
Happening.
News Guy Sully?
Yeah, News Guy Sully.
News
and
Guy
Cairo
Sully
traffic,
on Twitter.
But News Guy Sully. There's a lot of football stuff there about my son, but primarily it's
yeah,
about
just
it's
mute
about
all
construction.
That stuff. Just insufferable. Yeah, we got it. Your kid's a football player. Chris Sullivan from
I'm proud of my baby.
Did they win?
Yeah, they did. Somehow they hung on and won on the Inferno, which you don't know anything about, but that's okay. I can explain
yeah,
it
I don't
off
know.
The air.
I don't care. They did better than the Seahawks. That's all you have to say. Chris Sullivan, thanks for stopping by.
Anytime.
Now this.
The monologue.
I can't say that I'm shocked that this is a story involving Congressman Al Green. No, not the late singer Al Green. But Congressman Al Green is just lying to you, and he's preying on your insecurities. He gave an interview on Fox News where he said, in defense of the 87,000 new IRS agents that are going to be hired over the course of the next decade, that that's going to bring down inflation.
And that will bring down inflation. That will bring down gas prices. That will bring down the price of bread and food markets.
Bread and food markets? What decade are you living in?
Harassing taxpaying Americans will bring down inflation?
No
Is that what you're
it's
saying?
No secret that, it's no secret that people have disdain for the IRS. There's no secret. And if that's the plan, then I'd like to see how that plan is going to impact all of these things that are really impacting the economy.
So unless he thinks, number one, that inflation and gas prices will be a crisis a decade from now, you know just from the start that he's lying to you. Number two, no one believes that this, even in the short term, will have any impact whatsoever. Not even a minuscule impact on inflation and the cost of gas. First of all, let's just listen to, remember their argument originally that they demanded that we hear. This is not about going after the average taxpayer. This is about going after the millionaires and billionaires. Now, we've since learned, of course, that that's nonsense. And there's been studies to show that from the CBO. You're going to have to go after everyday people in order to bring in these savings that they claimed. But let's say that that was the truth, that they're going to go after the people who are cheating the IRS out of money that is due. What's realistically the fastest way you can get that done, that you'll collect? Let's just say you started today. And of course, remember, 87,000 IRS agents over the course of the next decade. Let's just presume, for the sake of argument, they hired every single one of them today, 87,000 today. How soon are you going to be able to look into the millionaires and billionaires to get the money that they owe and collect that money? And how exactly does that jibe with how much money you're spending on the Inflation Reduction Act and all those specific pieces of legislation that you're moving for, or programs that you're moving through that's supposed to help on climate change? Because when you look at the Inflation Reduction Act, every single economist, except for the hardcore lefties who are actively lying, every single one said it won't have an impact at all on inflation and there won't really be any cost savings. It'll pay for itself under the plan if it works the way that they claim. So how exactly does that bring down the cost of gas, which is driven up or down by a combination of factors, including supply and demand? So how does this go after inflation? How does this cool off the economy? Because unless you do that, you're going to continue to see inflation go through the roof. So exactly how does that work? He doesn't even attempt to answer that question. He just lazily says it will do X, Y, and Z, thinking that because he said it, we're all going to believe it. Shame on him for pushing that lie, and shame on anyone else who amplifies it. And kudos to, I think that was Griff Jenkins, pushing back on that just absolute lame talking point. Seriously, just see, the reason why this should annoy us more than maybe it does, because we've all heard politicians lie and mislead. He's doing this to get to people who are truly concerned right now about how they're going to afford their rent and groceries and their medication because of the inflationary impact on their own personal finances. He's telling them, don't worry, we've got your back by coming after you with the IRS. And someone's going to fall for this, and it's someone who's already vulnerable. So shame on them. Now this.
The interview.
Well, it appears that we have another instance of Democrat lawmakers allowing for judges to go easy on degenerates who should be spending a lot of time in jail. Joining me on the line to discuss a case out of Thurston County is an attorney, Paul Crowley. Paul, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jason. Thanks for having me.
So this is an issue concerning a guy named Ronald Clayton. He's being sentenced today for the attempted murder of a Thurston County deputy. Take us through what's going on, because it would appear that some folks don't want us to know what's actually happening.
Well, so Clayton is a guy who's been in the system since on attempted murder in 1995. He's been in and out. He was initially sentenced for attempted rape, having pled down from attempted murder. After his release, he's basically been in and out on failure to register. In 2019, he was out on his own with an ankle monitor, which he cut off and promptly disappeared, leading to a manhunt. And he did the same thing more recently. Unfortunately, this second round led to a police officer being stabbed in the neck and chest.
Okay, so he ends up getting caught for that. How's the deputy doing?
She's doing, you know, physically she's doing all right. She's got the kind of scars you don't want to see in anybody, but certainly not somebody who's young. You know, I don't want to speak for her, but I would say it's fair to say that she's having a difficult time. She's a tough woman. But you don't go through something like that without carrying some emotional scars as well as physical scars.
Absolutely. So you would think that given this guy's background, given this attempted murder, that, you know, he gets some sort of score based on his history, his criminal history. He gets in front of a judge. A judge is looking at a sentencing guidelines, a range of years that he would be put behind bars. My assumption is he would get the majority, the maximum.
Well, that's, you know, that's the expectation, although this is a guy who historically has gotten off pretty lightly. The worst example, I think, is one of the times that he was sentenced in the past. They erroneously sentenced him to, I think, 5 years was the max, and they said, oh, we'll give you a reduced sentence to only a few months. It turned out after the fact that the max was 10 years, not 5 years, and they never went back and corrected it. So this guy has skated at every opportunity.
Why do you think he's been able to skate?
You know, some of it I think is because he's been Thurston County, Pierce County, Kitsap County, King County. And, you know, it's not been a situation where it's just one county dealing with the guy. You know, beyond that, I'm not really sure. It's never made sense to me when you look at this guy's record that he's been given, you know, one chance after another without really showing anything that to suggest that he deserved those chances. There's no evidence of remorse. There's no evidence of rehabilitation.
Well, you've indicated to me that you think that the state or the county is preparing to basically quietly give this guy the low range. Why do you think that? Is it just based on how he's been treated in the past?
Well, you know, I've never understood the prioritization of prosecutions. I mean, you can't try every single case. I think everybody understands that. But you've got to have some priorities about which ones you choose to try.
Mm-hmm.
And when you almost kill a police officer, and I guess, you know, as a technical matter, she was dead. She had to be resuscitated. This is a serious incident. And to me, attacks on law enforcement should be absolutely prioritized, but they're giving this guy a plea deal. And I think if they put it in front of a jury would come down on him like a ton of bricks. And that's not happening here.
No, and again, I'm not necessarily shocked at this. We've been seeing this happen, to your point, just really all across Western Washington. And I'm willing to bet if I took a deeper dive into Eastern Washington, we're probably seeing something similar, maybe not quite as bad as we're seeing it in Western Washington. And the reason why I opened this conversation, not just talking about a judge, but also the lawmakers, is, you know, the lawmakers, at the end of the day, they can change either certain laws or really sentencing guidelines, right? I mean, when we're looking at a range, that's set by lawmakers in Olympia, and they could choose to go harder on people who definitely need to be put in jail, and they're making the choice not to. I'll give you the final word.
Well, absolutely, Jason, and it really is priorities from the top down. This is a man who, frankly, belongs behind bars, whatever way we can get him behind bars. He belongs there forever because he is going to be a danger to his fellow citizens until the day he dies. And the decision to give this guy any kind of break, even if it's just a downward deviation on the sentencing guidelines, just does not make any sense whatsoever.
No, it doesn't. But we are living in Washington State in the year 2022, and apparently this is the new norm. But thankfully, we got folks like you who are at least calling it out, bringing attention, and maybe some folks will start paying attention in the courts, understanding that there will be political consequences if this kind of nonsense continues, because it makes us all less safe in the state. We've been talking with Paul Crowley. He's an attorney. Thank you so much for coming on. I really do appreciate you highlighting the story.
Thanks for having me, Jason.
Now this. The IRS continues to be aggressive. They're increasing the number of officers in Washington State. Hey, it's Jason Rance here. Don't try to take on the IRS yourself. Contact our local tax expert and advocate, Greg Nunn, at Nunn Better Tax Resolution for help. N-U-N-N, Nunn Better Tax Resolution.
Realtors abide by a code of ethics. This is Article 9 in action. Beth, a first-time homebuyer, knew nothing about the home buying process, except that she wanted to buy a home. But her realtor had the expertise to make sure Beth understood every document, even giving her copies to review with her lawyer so Beth could close on her first home with confidence. Complicated things explained in simple terms. The difference between an agent and a realtor is real. Realtors are members of the National Association of Realtors. That's who we are.
Roof now, pay later. Zero down, zero payments, and zero interest up to 18 months. Call the professionals at Acton's Quality Roofing to lock in these special rates today. Call 1-800-ROOFTOP to schedule a free estimate or visit actonsroofing.com. Our family has your family covered.
Hey, for some reason, in this Biden economy, people are buying a lot of new guns. And I hope they're learning how to use them. I hope you are. Hey, it's Todd Herman. For someone else you need to know about, it's Northwest Safe. So if you're new to owning firearms to defend yourself and your family, you got to make sure you store them up the right way. My friends at Northwest Safe are the experts at this. It's nwsafe.com.
The Jason Rance Show.
Jason Rance has followed that in detail. He's a radio host in Seattle. He broke the story. He joins us now.
Never shy of his opinion. Jason, definitely letting you know how he feels about that.
Wow. You laid that down.
Long Form, presented by Northgate Rare Coins and Precious Metals.
You know, we hear a lot about the need to support teachers and how there is a shortage and it's just not fair on the kids. And yet it seems to me that we're still implementing a whole lot of policies that don't make sense, but do make it harder on the very teachers to go into the classroom, get in front of your kids, and actually impart to them some knowledge. Joining me on the line is a teacher from the Edmonds School District. We're keeping his name private for now for fear of reprisals, but he's got an interesting story of an experience that he's currently going through out of Edmonds, and he joins me now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So this is a very long and ongoing series of dramatic moments with the school district. It's all tied to COVID. So if you could just step back and take us from the beginning to where we are now.
Sure. So obviously with the COVID-19 shutdowns, the teachers all went to remote schooling, which is an entirely story in and of itself. But as we started to transition back to the in-person model, teachers who were refusing to be vaccinated for religious and or medical reasons had various different measures that were imposed upon them by the state and the different school districts. And that's where I've been experiencing some significant issues, inclusive of invasions of my personal autonomy by being required to undergo weekly COVID screenings, even though it's been well established that the COVID shots do not prevent the contraction or the spread of the virus.
Yeah.
And so I've been standing firmly saying that if other people in the building, inclusive of the students, are not being tested, and I'm clearly not ill, I have not been exposed in a close contact, then they would have no reason to test me because everyone else is being untested just because they chose to undergo a medical decision to get the COVID-19 shot.
And that point, I think, is really important because it would be different if the vaccine stopped the spread of COVID, but it doesn't. And so there's no difference as far as the spread of COVID is concerned between you and someone who's vaccinated.
That's absolutely correct. And so as we transition back into schools, teachers that were had the shots or did not have the shots were all required to wear masks. And I pushed back specifically because students who are learning English, as well as those who have learning disabilities, as well as auditory issues, like students that are hard of hearing, are needing to see our faces and hear that verbal communication in a more clear manner. And so I was able to wear a face shield, as was some of the other teachers in our building as well. We chose to do the face shield with a drape when the mask requirement was in place. And now that the state has transitioned to lifting all of those mask mandates for all the K-12 teachers, the governor, as well as the Department of Health, have said that school districts can continue to implement whatever measures they deem necessary. And so the Edmond School District has chosen to continue restrictive measures, including weekly testing, as well as mask requirements for only the unvaccinated staff. And they say that that is because it does not address the increased public health risk, cost, and other burden associated with my unvaccinated status. And that's actually a quote that I just got from the superintendent at a letter that they sent me.
Oh, I bet. And the argument is effectively stating that if you're vaccinated, it cuts down on the likelihood of you, once you get COVID, and everyone will eventually get COVID, once you get it, you won't be out as long. You won't have you'll have a lower likelihood of being hospitalized. I'm actually not certain the data shows that anymore, but certainly at one point it did show that. But using that argument, do they tell people that they can't smoke, that they can't drink regular Coke, that they can't eat candy, that they can't have white bread? Do they do any of those rules?
Of course not. And you make a very good point that initially, with the outset of the COVID pandemic, the Moderna, Pfizer, and J&J and other products that were on the market did attenuate the symptomologies of people who did contract the COVID virus. But now, with the onset of Omicron and even with Delta, we've seen that waning efficacy of those products, which is why they're now pushing the boosters. And I'm certain that the district is going to take the steps to implement the booster requirements as well. They just haven't released that yet.
So where do things stand right now? Are you able to go into the classroom and teach?
No, actually, since December of last year, because I've pushed back and refused to be weekly tested, because that's just a violation and a search of my person without warrant, they booted me out of the classroom last winter. And at the outset of this year, even though the mandates were lifted, they have actually kicked me off campus multiple times because I showed up for work and they said, nope, you can't be here.
So what are do you work remotely then? What are they doing?
So at this moment, they have put me on an indefinite administrative leave without pay.
Without pay. And what's the reason?
Pay. Because I am refusing to comply with their mandates.
And you, you're a non-union teacher, correct?
That is correct. I'm taking advantage of the fact that about 6 or 7 years ago, Washington State, through the courts, passed that if you feel the union doesn't represent you or your values, you can choose not to pay them money to represent you. And that was the difference between a union member and the fair share payers. And so I don't have to pay the union because they don't represent me. But unfortunately, I now have to fight for myself.
Yeah, so I'm wondering, do you have any regrets of not joining the union in a very, very specific moment like this?
You know, not at all. The peoples in the union, my understanding, are negotiating these sorts of provisions with the school districts themselves, and they're agreeing to implement these policies onto their employees and their members.
Yeah, so you'd be effectively in the same position, although I don't know if they would negotiate a suspension without pay. They still do have to follow some basic rules and agreements. Is this kosher, putting you on unpaid leave?
My understanding is that this would be possible. I've not been able to dive deeper into the contractual obligations that the district has regarding the union negotiated deals, but that certainly is a good question.
Then what are you going to do? I think you're right. I don't think that the district is all of a sudden going to change course. I think this is it's cult-like in their adherence to these types of rules, and they love the idea of the symbolism that's shown by someone who's either wearing a mask while vaccinated or put in a mask because they're not vaccinated. It's kind of weird. But I think you're right. I think they'll probably go with the boosters, and it doesn't seem they're going to reverse course. So what are you going to do?
Well, you know, in the meantime, I am actively seeking counsel and am, you know, raising the awareness with through conversations like this, which is something I very much appreciate because, you know, the districts and the students and the peoples in our community need to know that the school districts as agents of the government are still implementing these policies, even though it appears to be lightened up magically at the end of October, which is, of course, just in time for the midterm elections.
Yeah. No kidding. So what response do you get when you talk about this with other folks, maybe colleagues or even students?
You know, in front of students, I actually am bound by that professional obligation to keep any of my personal and political values out of my classroom based on the subjects that I teach. And I take that very seriously. And so my students are completely unaware of any of my medical status or my personal stances on any issues. With regards to my colleagues, they just shake their head and they're afraid to speak up because they don't want this to happen to them.
So that you get the sense that they generally agree with you but don't want to say anything?
I would say that the people I've been able to speak to say that it's wrong. And then they just, you can clearly tell by their body language, they just don't know really what to do.
Yeah.
And they've kind of been cowed by a lot of other issues that are going on. And they've seen sort of the environmental shifts within the schools themselves that make them fearful for losing their career.
Well, as we wrap things up, take me through just briefly, why did you decide to make this your stand? Because, you know, a lot of people, I'm assuming, feel exactly the same way. But they ended up giving in and getting the vaccine maybe reluctantly, or maybe they would have otherwise, but they kind of resent the way that they felt pressured into doing it.
Certainly. You know, my familiarity with the actual science of products, of how these science, these are a product, right? I would even quiver on the idea of calling these vaccinations specifically because of their formulation and the technology that's used within them. It's so similar to how we introduced stable integrating genes in laboratory cells that it just did not seem to me that it was reliable as a safe method for doing a vaccination in humans. And that's on top of how they were developed and my personal moral convictions. Mm-hmm. So coupling all of those things together, I just had to say no, because I'm not just fighting for myself at this point. I'm fighting for the future with our children, my children, and other people's children who may want to say no later. But if we don't give them those opportunities, then they're just gone, because we as the older generation squandered their opportunity to choose for themselves.
I really do wish people would think about it in those terms, because this is not about the vaccine. It's not about whether or not it's efficacious. It's not about any of those issues. You're welcome to hold any position on that that you want. It's the question as to whether or not the government has the right to force you into something like this that you don't want to do. Or even if you're okay with doing, it's still a question to me of whether or not the government should have the right to do it. And I think that is a slippery slope to go down. Again, why isn't the flu shot mandatory? Why isn't, you know, a ban on the sale and consumption of sugary beverages and sugary foods? Why is that unacceptable? But this is. So there are a lot of questions that have to be answered. And look, at the end of the day, it's the Edmond School District yet again showing that it doesn't really side with the kids. It sides with bureaucracy. It sides with politics. We've been talking with a teacher from the Edmonds School District. We wish you the best of luck in whatever happens next.
I appreciate your time, sir, and thank you for fighting the fight.
Absolutely. Thank you. You're listening to The Jason Rant Show.
The Jason Rant Show.
Let's bring in our man in the Pacific Northwest, KTTH, Seattle top radio host Jason Rants.
Great to have you with us to tell people a little bit more about this.
Jason Rants is in focus now.
Jason Rants, thank you for your reporting on that.
The Quick Hit.
So I follow the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. And they are a nonpartisan group. They primarily focus on conservative issues only because their scope is looking at the attacks against free speech rights on college campuses. That's their main focus. And for the most part, the people who are being attacked on campus are conservatives. They're seeing their speech being shut down. But in this case, they have a story that truly is a nonpartisan story. And it shows you just how much of a joke some quote-unquote educators can be. And I know that someone might hear this next story and say, well, the intentions were good. I don't care if you think the intentions were good. Sometimes people with good intentions don't use basic logic. In this case, we have a student who goes to a school in Utah, the University of Utah, 21 years old. Her name is Meredith Miller. And on September 21st, ahead of a football game, she posted on the social media app Yik Yak, which I've never heard of, but it allows students to post comments anonymously, which does not sound like a healthy social media platform. But she said, if we don't win today, I'm detonating the nuclear reactor on campus. That's it. She was punished. They tracked her down and punished her. Because according to the university police chief, Jason Hinojosa, who arrested her, said they have, quote, a zero tolerance policy for these kinds of threats. He said, in the age that we're living in, we have to take every threat seriously. The police department, according to Fire, claimed that Miller had, quote, knowledge of the nuclear reactor on campus and attended class in the same building as the reactor. Oh, really? The police were able to trace the post to this woman. She admitted writing it. They booked her into Salt Lake City County Jail. They released her the same night with a bail of $5,000. And now she faces a charge of making a terroristic threat. This is absurd. This is next level absurd. There is not a single person, not a single reasonable person who could listen to that line, read that line, hear that line, and come out and say, well, this is a clear and obvious threat. It's not even a questionable threat. It's not even like someone could say, man, you know what? I guess it could go either way. Like, I can see it as a joke, but maybe not, you know. Yeah, let's just play it safe. No. No. This is very clearly the use of hyperbole. It's very clearly a joke. It's not offensive. It is nowhere close to what anyone would call a threat. And for a police chief to make this determination, and this is part of the university system, this is someone who should at least understand that they're dealing with college students who will make jokes. And by the way, again, this isn't even a politically incorrect joke. This isn't even a marginal joke where you're like, oh, well, I don't know. This is very clearly a joke. This is a person, an adult, who supposedly has gut instincts on top of just being able to use reason and logic, who read this and decided, yeah, I'm going to form an investigation, track the student down, and put them in jail. In what world are we living that this is acceptable, even if we say the intent was there, that this was done with good intentions? He was just out of an abundance of caution. Shame on him as well. I'm doing a lot of shaming this hour of people tied to schools. But shame on him. How dare he? And how dare the DA there even consider this? Now, we don't know what's going to happen. We haven't seen, and I haven't seen at least, an update from the Salt Lake Union, Salt Lake County District Attorney. But how you cannot call this a mistake and apologize profusely is beyond me. And the only thing that's getting in the way of an apology and drop charges, well, two things getting in the way. Number one, fear that you'll get sued by her, and I hope she does sue you for everything that you're worth. And number two, stubbornness. These are people who are stubborn. They never want to admit that they are wrong. They never want to admit that they overreacted, because in their own heads, they've decided that they are heroes. They have determined themselves to be heroes. See, I just saved the school from a nuclear meltdown. And that way they can go about living their lonely, boring lives in which they do nothing meaningful. They can live that life thinking, oh, I'm a hero, because they don't view what they currently do as meaningful. That's not me saying it. That's what they believe. I think being an officer on a campus or elsewhere is meaningful work. Just showing up every single day and keeping the community safe. But when you get someone who doesn't think that they're actually doing anything in their job or don't take meaning from their job, just by going through the normal routine, you get something like this. Absolute disgusting story.
The Last Rants.
And by the way, now that I'm shaming people, I might as well just fully embrace this. Hey, white ladies who are progressive, stop saying Latinx. Hey, white dudes who are baristas, who are DE&I consultants for corporations, stop saying Latinx or Latinx. That's not a word. That is a word that you invented as a white person to try to label people who are Hispanic or Latin American or Mexican or Spanish, because you put everyone into the same group. Latinx doesn't mean anything. Other than it is your way of trying to signal to the brown people that you're so desperate to become a friend with, that you get it, that you're on their side. Except they don't see it as you being on their side. They see it as you being a condescending left-wing hack who doesn't actually care about them. You just want to tokenize them. That's why you don't have any brown friends, because you call them brown people, because you call them Latinx. So desperate for a friend. How about this? Treat everyone equally. Stop trying to word police around it and stop making up new words to signal how amazing you are, because you're not amazing. You're not a hero. You're annoying. And that's the last rants.